Okay. Hello, everybody. Sorry for all the difficulty. This has been quite an adventure. You see, you remember 2 weeks ago, I gave the introductory lecture. Then we decided to redo that because some people were saying they didn't get good sound quality on the recording when they're trying to listen to it after the live lecture. Now, of course, there's a possibility the reason didn't like sound quality, maybe it was just my voice. After all, I sound like Droopy Dog on sleeping pills. But anyway, we decided they were going to get me a new computer. They're going to get me a new computer. So then the new computer arrived, and Danny Sanchez installed it, but unfortunately, we couldn't figure out what the password is, so now we have to go to Starbucks. And we're doing it on Danny's laptop, so we're hoping if we have to re-record this, at least you'll have another, those of you who heard the first lecture, at least you'll have another lecture to listen to. Okay, now today, the previous lecture I covered the introduction. Today we're going to cover chapter 1 of Human Action, which is called Acting Man. Now, when Mises was writing, you know, of course he wrote in politically incorrect time, so by man he means human beings. If anybody doesn't like that, you should just be aware that was what Mises had in mind. He didn't mean just male. So we're talking today about one of the most basic concepts in the whole book. After all, the book is called Human Action. So today we're going to talk about what action is. Now, as I say, it's the most basic concept in praxeology. You would expect this because praxeology is a science of human action, so it makes sense that action would be the most basic concept. That's a pretty simple inference. In fact, it's one that maybe even people who aren't very smart could get, like those who write articles on universally preferable behavior. Okay, so as I say, action is the most basic concept in praxeology. You'd expect this because, after all, praxeology is the science of human action. And I just made a nasty remark that even stupid people like those who write about universally preferable behavior should be able to get that inference, although I doubt that they're going to be able to do it. Oh, somebody said the audio has gotten worse again. That's probably because I'm on. Okay, so action, what is action? Well, that was good. Steve thinks my joke is funny. Good. Okay, so action is purposeful behavior. Now, a very important thing to notice here is that action is in the world. Mises isn't just talking about mere thoughts, like, say, I'd like to, let's say, I have the thought, I'd like to give a lecture on human action. So just thinking about that wouldn't qualify as an action. It's giving the lecture that's the action. So the behavior has to have physical effect. And we'll see, this is a very important point, it will come in later quite a bit, that action is behavior in the world, not just thinking about things. So one example, one instance of avoidance misunderstanding comes in with psychoanalysis. Mises was very interested in psychoanalysis. What goes on in the Freudian unconscious or subconscious subconscious isn't itself action. You can see why not. Everybody see why not? Because remember, something goes on in the Freudian unconscious. That's just a thought, an unconscious thought. It isn't an action because it's not taking place in the world. So it means it doesn't count that as action. Of course, we don't believe in the Freudian unconscious. If we don't think anything's going on in it, then that's another reason not to think it's an action. Now, although, this is a side point, although Mises didn't think that what goes on in the Freudian unconscious is action, he still thought very highly of psychoanalysis, and he thought the value of psychoanalysis for praxeology is that it shows that some behavior not really classed as previously classed as action really is action. For example, supposing you just saw somebody making some kind of meaningless body movement, you might think, well, that's not action, he's just kind of swinging his hands around in some kind of meaningless way, so it's not purposeful behavior, but maybe the psychoanalyst could show there's some meaning to that, so the person in this moving his arms and hands in this way is really trying to express some kind of unconscious thought, so it would count as action. So Mises thinks by use of psychoanalysis, you can extend what is involved in the notion of action sometimes. But you don't have to accept that to go along with what's involved in phraseology. And just as a point of interest, Mises knew Freud personally. They weren't that close friends, but they didn't know each other. Now, sometimes it's hard to tell. Wait, I see yet. Even that's an interesting question. Even though unintentional could be action. No, that's a very good question. No, what the case there would be is it's intentional, but it's an unconscious intention. So the Freudian idea is that you can have intentional behavior that isn't the person acting isn't immediately conscious of, although we presumably, at least in many cases, could be brought to understand. So the Freudian view is intentional, but not conscious. That was a very good question. Okay, so as I say, sometimes it's hard to tell whether something qualifies as an action. For example, walking is certainly an action. What about the particular steps you take while you're walking? Mostly we do this without conscious attention. We don't say to ourselves, well, I'm going to take one step, then another step. I just got some water that will keep you going. Okay, so we wouldn't say, well, we're taking individual steps, so does that count our individual steps action, because we're not paying attention to the individual steps. I won't resist telling you one of my jokes here. There was a man who went into a barber shop, and he had earphones on. So the barber said to him, would you take off the earphones? He said, no, I don't want to do that. Just cut around. So the barber found that very difficult to do, but Eventually, the man fell asleep, and the barber figured, well, he could just unplug the earphones and the fellow wouldn't know. But after he unplugged the earphones, the man just suddenly gasped and dropped dead. So they had to call an ambulance, and they took the person away. And then the barber was feeling very upset, and he was wondering, what was the fellow listening to on the earphone so important? He didn't want to disrupt, didn't want to be interrupted. So he put on the earphones and he heard, breathe in, breathe out, breathe in, breathe out. But see, this person would have been taking breathing as a conscious action, but most people don't do that. So, as I say, there's a borderline case, but it's hard to say, does something qualify as an action? Would the individual steps qualify? Certainly walking is an action, but what about the individual steps? Now we'll see what Mises' answer to this particular question is very soon, unless I act like this man in the barber chair and collapse. But Mises makes a very important philosophical point about this borderline case. And the important point is the existence of borderline cases doesn't imply that the concept itself is unclear. As an example, we know what the difference is between, say, someone is bald and not bald, even though there's no exact criterion for when someone is bald. You know, bald means not having hair on your head. Not bald, someone does have hair, and you have to say, well, I'm pretty bald. Say someone else, Danny Sanchez. Sanchez is not bald. But we'd be pretty clear on that, but we don't have the exact criteria. You can't say, well, if you have so-and-so many numbers, so-and-so many hairs on your head, then you're bald. But if you have more than that, then you're not. So there's no exact way to separate bald from not bald, but the concept still is clear. So the same is true for a human action. There's sometimes cases very difficult to say, is this a case of action or is it not action? But doesn't even follow from that the concept of human action is unclear. But this is, I think, a very good point. Mises makes a very good philosophical point. He says, just because there are borderline cases doesn't follow that the concept is unclear. As some of you may be familiar, if you're not, you may want to look up a very good essay. You got this on the Mises.org site called Profit and Loss. And Mises uses this point I just made, namely that existence of borderline cases doesn't show the concept is unclear. He used this point to criticize the philosopher L.S. Debbie. She was a lady, Lizzie Susan Debbie. She taught at the University of London. And here, Debbie was writing, he thought very highly of Debbie's logician, but she was writing and she was talking about businesses who earn excess profit. So here Mises says, look, it's not just that we don't have a clear criterion for what is an excess profit, but how much, today some people say, well, the oil companies are earning enormous profits and it's too much. But we don't have an exact criterion, but here Mises says we don't have a clear concept at all of what an excess profit is. So you see the difference between human action and excess profit. There are borderline cases in human action. We could say we're not sure about some particular thing, like individual steps people take when they're walking, whether their action, but excess profits is different because we don't have a clear concept. Okay, yeah, we're just going to make a switch here. Okay, let's hope that makes the sound a little better. It's awful that people in this Starbucks are intent on their own conversations and not willing to have absolute silence so I can give my lecture. You can't see, someone can't see my face while you're, let me see how I'm doing. Paper working on this. Oh, okay. How about now? Can you see me now? All right. Well, you were probably better off when you couldn't see me. Okay. Maybe I offered them free coffee. That wouldn't shut them up. I know these people. It takes more than coffee to shut them up. But it's a good question. Now, Stephen said, is that conception different from Obama's fair share scenario? I don't think, I mean, I have to look at what Obama said, but I'm inclined to think that's another good example of the notion of what is a fair share. There's no clear concept there, so that's a very good point. Okay. Now, what would Mises say about the example of walking I gave before? Remember, the example I gave was, well, clearly, walking is an action. I'm going for a walk. That's certainly purposeful behavior. But the question I raised is, what about the individual steps? I normally don't think about individual steps that I take on walking. So what I think Mises would say about that is that something counts as action so long as it could be under your conscious control. So it doesn't have to be actually under your conscious control as long as it could be. So I could, if I wanted to when I walk, just think about each step that I'm taking. It wouldn't be a very good idea, but I could do it, so Mises would say that counts as action. The individual steps do count as action because I could keep them under my conscious control if I wanted to. Now, so we've had so far, we've had the question, why? Oh, now, someone has an interesting point here. Someone says, you don't mind a personal example. I have a neurological condition where I do have to concentrate to walk. Oh, that's interesting. I mean, there are certainly cases like that. I mean, that is an interesting point. I wasn't familiar with that. It's interesting to know that. So we dealt so far in the talk in what does Mises, what is action? We talked about human action. So what is action? It's purposeful behavior, but it's action in the world. And now we have a different question: is why act? Why do we act? So, what Mises says is we act because we're dissatisfied that our present situation and want to change it. So, suppose I say, I don't like all these other people talking in the Starbucks, so I'll just machine gun them all to shut them up. So that would be an action I don't like the status quo now. So I'm going to act to change it. So supposing you weren't dissatisfied, everything's fine, then you wouldn't have any need to ask if you don't want to change anything. And actually, I have another one of my jokes for you there. There was a family who had a little boy, and the boy appeared to be very smart, but he never said anything. And he'd gotten to be 5 years old, and he hadn't said a word, and the parents were very worried about him. But then one day at breakfast, he said, the eggs are too salty. So his mother said, you mean you can talk? Why didn't you say anything before this? And he said, up till now, everything was all right. Now, it seems that we just get a refund if the crop is in the slab. Well, I think if you ask for a refund, you say you had poor, we couldn't process your request because you had poor audio. We couldn't follow what you were saying. Now, okay, so what I said so far is we ask because we're dissatisfied. But now I'm going to introduce a slight complication. Suppose, oh, actually someone said jails have Wi-Fi. Well, I take it you have more experience with jails than I do. Okay, so what's the complication? Suppose everything is fine now, but it won't be unless we ask. We would still have reason to ask. So this is actually, it's an interesting point. I won't go into it now, but Mises at one point in the book gives an argument that if God exists, he couldn't ask because he couldn't be dissatisfied that God is, by definition, the first being. And that argument, I don't think, works just because of its complication. As long as the being could be perfectly satisfied, he could still ask because he thinks if he doesn't ask, he wouldn't be satisfied. But don't worry about that. You don't get it. It's just kind of a minor complication. I like that sort of thing. But the basic point is, if you think action involves your satisfaction, you'll be covering about 99.9% of all the cases, so that's what you need to concentrate. Now, Mises said, well, we're acting because we're dissatisfied. So what are we trying to do when we act? So obviously we want to remove the dissatisfaction. The way we do that would obviously depend on the specific action one has in mind, but what we're trying to do is remove the dissatisfaction. So in this sense, we said that all action aims at happiness. Now this is an extremely important point to understand. Happiness has to be understood in a purely formal way. What I mean by that is the term is just a placeholder for whatever we're aiming at when we act. So it isn't really a substantive thesis. These are just things, well, when you're acting, you're aiming at something, you're trying to achieve something, you have a goal, you're dissatisfied because you don't have this goal, so you're trying to achieve the goal, and you're going to call whatever that end or goal is happiness. So he isn't saying something like some philosophers have always aim mostly at getting certain pleasant experiences, or all action just aims at advancing our individual welfare. Jesus isn't saying anything like that. He's not making a controversial claim at all. It's just a tautology, just a, when we're acting, we're trying to achieve happiness, where happiness is just the goal of what we want. So suppose, let's say you have something like an act of self-sacrifice. Let's say I'm in the army and I see someone throwing a grenade at all these others that will blow up all the people in my unit, and I just fall on the grenade in order to, because I want to save the other people in the unit. That would count as, my falling on the grenade would count as aiming for happiness, because that's what I want to do. I want to save the people, other people's unit. It doesn't mean that the reason I'm falling on the grenade is I just get this ecstatic feeling of happiness when I think that I'm saving all these people's lives, and that outweighs the badness of my dying. It isn't a matter of feeling at all. It's just that's the goal I wanted, so that's what counts as aiming at happiness. So a lot of people miss this. I saw, it was recently an article in a magazine misnamed the American Thinker, which I saw Jesus saying people just aim at happiness in some kind of narrow, selfish sense that they want to earn as much money as possible. But that is what Jesus is saying. He's just saying that whatever you want counts as happiness. So, as I said, the statement, the aim of action is happiness, is a tautology. So, what do we mean by a tautology? It's a statement that's made true by the meaning of the terms in it. Like, say a bachelor is an unmarried male, that's true just because of the meaning of the term. It isn't saying anything really new. So a tautology, say the aim of action is happiness, you're not really saying anything that's controversial, because it means you're taking happiness just to be another way of referring to whatever the aim of action is. So the important thing to understand about this, it isn't a controversial point at all. It neither relates to views to the ancient Greeks, and he refers to the Epicurean tradition in philosophy. Epicurus, who lived from 341 to 270 BC, taught that we aim at a state of perfect mental peace, avaricia, but this is never reached. So you see the similarity with what Jesus is saying. He's saying we're acting to remove dissatisfaction, and Epicurus says, well, we're aiming at a state where we're not dissatisfied at all because there's perfect mental peace. You see, Epicurus' views have much more substantive content than Mises. Mises just saying whatever you aim at counts as action. But Epicurus has definite ideas on how we can attain perfect mental peace, and he's not trying to free our mind from desiring things. But that isn't part of that theology. Now, can the view that we act be challenged? It sounds pretty uncontroversial to make people act. Like, how could anybody deny that. Now, one position challenges the view that human beings act is behaviorism, which is a doctrine in psychology, and J.B. Watt and B.F. Skinner were very famous behaviorist psychologists. They're saying to the behaviorists, well, look, how can you possibly say people don't act? Well, look, Art, don't just have to look around. You can be walking, giving lectures, doing things all the time. How can you possibly say that people don't act? So what behaviorists would say, well, sure, you have behavior of people doing things, but their consciousness isn't relevant in explaining what they're doing. So behaviorists would say, sure, I'm giving a lecture now, but I'm not, in their view, giving a lecture because I have the idea I want to give a lecture, so I'm going to do that. Their idea was to explain what I'm doing, we just have to refer to the physical behavior, namely the sound coming out of my mouth. If some of you were right before, there's not loud enough sound. If there are sounds coming out, so that's all you need to explain what I'm doing. You don't have to refer to purposeful behavior. Now, that isn't too plausible a view, and Mises doesn't really say all that much about it. But there's another group that opposes Mises. I guess it was popular at the time he was writing Human Action, slightly before, which was called instinct psychology. And Mises mentions William Usual in this. And actually, he was kind of an odd psychologist. He was interested in parapsychology, and he was also a very strong proponent of eugenics and kind of somewhat fascist in his views, but he was popular psychologist at one time. So, what this group is somewhat different from behaviorists, that they say we act from input, not unconscious control. So see, this is going against according to Mises, we're acting when our behavior is purposeful, we're dissatisfied with something, so we consciously decide to change things, to act, or we could bring what we're doing under conscious control. But according to instinct psychology, we look at matters a different way. Let's imagine this situation. You're standing in line, say there's a movie you want to see, Mises biography, maybe movie. So you're standing in line to see that someone pushes ahead of you, and then you respond with very angry words. I won't say what the words are because we don't want this to be an X-rated lecture. So, according to instinct psychology, your anger follows from instinct. You don't say to yourself, this person has been rude to me, so I'm going to respond by saying something bad to him. You just do something. Let's see how this would show again what Mises is saying, in that Mises says, well, action is purposeful behavior, but the instinct psychologist would say, no, we're just doing things because we have instinct to do. So you can see Mises' reply to this line of thought, how a point I raised earlier comes in. Remember I said, according to Mises, besides conscious actions that are under our conscious control. Something counts for as action as long as it could be under our conscious control. So Mises says, well, even in this kind of case I just given, we could decide to suppress our anger to say, well, it wouldn't be a good idea to react angrily to this person who pushed ahead of us, maybe 8 feet tall, just squash us, protest us off. We won't do anything. So as long as we could control our instincts, we're acting. I think Tom Miller asked a very good question. What about the analysis of the instinct that acts? Well, I think the instinct psychologists would say yes, they are certainly analyzing action, but they're not denying that we ever act at all. They're just saying most human behavior isn't conscious of instinct. So your point is a good one. They wouldn't be able to deny altogether that there is such a thing as action in the sense of purposeful behavior. And like they wanted to say, analyze, there's also an instinct to analyze things, that wouldn't be very plausible. But they could still say most behavior is instinctive. Now, Mises raises some other problems for this instinct psychology. Remember, what instinct psychology says is just gives different motives that we have for acting, like we're acting, there's an instinct for each of us, like an instinct to anger, instinct to achieve pleasure, that we're not engaged in purposeful behavior because we're acting from instinct. So Mises says, he first quotes the German philosopher Ludwig Feuerbach, that every instinct is an instinct to happiness. And what he has in mind there is that, remember, in Mises, we're doing an action is we're trying to remove dissatisfaction. We're not satisfied with the way things are, so we're saying, how can I make things better? So what Mises and Feuerbach are saying is that if you give these various instincts, they're just particular ways of achieving happiness that people have. They're just a way of classifying the immediate goals of action. So it isn't really, if you say we're acting from instinct, we're not really saying that we're going to give praxeology. We're just saying that this is a particular motive people might have for acting. Now, another point Mises makes criticizing instinct psychologists is, suppose you say something, we do something because we have an instinct to do it. It doesn't really explain anything. Like the famous case, remember Molière, where someone says that opium puts people to sleep because it has a dormative power, where dormative just means being able to put somebody to sleep. So you say opium puts people to sleep because it has the power to put people to sleep. It isn't really explaining anything. So if you say you're doing something because you have an instinct to do it, you're not really explaining anything. I think it's the type of criticism Mises gave. It was quite effective. I don't know if it's because his criticism or not, but instinct psychology isn't as popular now as it was when Mises was writing. The type of criticism he gave is one that actually many psychologists found ways that they come up with that sort of criticism. So I should say it's unusual that Mises agrees with Feuerbach, who is a materialist philosopher that had a very strong influence on Marx. So Mises usually doesn't agree with him, but here he does. Now, Mises then has a very neat move conceptually, I think this comes in near the end of the chapter, in a section called the serviceableness of instinct. So Mises says, look, the instinct school psychology, remember, they say that human beings are just like animals. Remember, animals act by instinct. Animals don't decide what to do. Say, if imagine there's a frog and then a fly is going by, the frog just sticks out its tongue and captures the fly and eats it. The frog isn't thinking to itself, well, oh, there goes the fly. Tastes very good, so I'll just stick out my tongue and get it. The fly is just acting instinctively. So the instinct is that human beings are like that. We just act by instinct. So Mises says, look, it's not just that human behavior can't be explained that way, but the way we very often understand animals who do operate by instinct is by using categories of phraseology. So animals don't really act, but we attribute actions to them, kind of, even though we know they're not really acting. By using the category, we can understand what they're doing. For example, you could say ants behave as if they decided to build an ant, but the ants haven't decided that. But if we look at what they're doing, you could imagine, say, people who were doing what they're doing, say, a lot of people want to build the hill, and that will enable us to understand what they're doing. Now, again, one thing we'll find in this chapter is very characteristic of Mises' work, is he's always trying to anticipate criticism of what he's saying to respond to. So what if somebody objects to praxeology, the science action that he has? Say, for instance, well, maybe we need to appeal to human action now, but maybe in the future we'll be able to show that all human behavior is determined by physical laws. What if everything in the brain, including our thought, can be explained by physical laws? So say just as we don't need to bring in purposeful behavior to explain why chemicals in the brain are doing certain things to react in a certain way. Maybe we'll be able to reduce thought to certain kinds of brain activity, then we won't need praxeology anymore. So one thing interesting to note, you might expect, and Mises is always talking about deductive structures a priori reasoning. Kind of at him to say, oh, well, this view is just philosophically impossible. The thought can't be reduced to activities in the brain. There are philosophers who say that, but Mises doesn't say that. He does not, does not reject the view that human thought just being reduced to the operation of the law. He calls this new monism. Everything is one monism, one So he says, he doesn't reject it as a philosophical view. He says, we can't establish that or competing views as truth. It's pretty much a philosophical agnostic on the nature of God. He says that we can't establish that it doesn't have a material basis or not, or is it something irreducible about us that we can't really find that out. But he says we can't, as things are now, go beyond human action. So as things are now, people might have philosophical theories that all action can be reduced to physical action in the brain. But he said, well, we can't, don't really know that, so for the present, we have to just take human action as what he called an ultimate given. So that's a very important category in some ultimate given, something that we can't go beyond. So if you say, well, maybe action can be reduced to something else, then maybe you're right, but we can't establish this, so we have to take a thought as an ultimate given, so we can't reduce thought to brain activity. We don't know how to do this, so we can't go beyond purposeful behavior and say, well, we could show by analysis the behavior wasn't purposeful because it's reduced to brain activity. We can't do that. We have to take action as an ultimate given. Now, Mises takes in the chapter another surprising position. He says all action is rational. Now, this sounds like a very odd thing to say. Aren't there all sorts of examples of irrational action, like trying to give a lecture in a noisy room? I can say that's rational. So Mises has an answer that he has a concept of rationality that's very easy to satisfy, which is that the actor, the person's acting, just has to regard the means he uses suitable to get what he wants. So you wouldn't have to be right about that holding. I hope this is correct. I mean, holding is a terrible idea. Give a lecture in Starbucks because there's too much noise. So as long as I thought it would be worth doing, it counted as rational, even if in fact the meaning wasn't suitable to get what I wanted. If I'm acting, I must think I the means are suitable. So it counts as rational in means of usage. So when you get that, I think, well, look, here's some examples of irrational action. People have all sorts of crazy ideas about things. Because Mises is going to say, on my notion of rationality, I have certain ends, and I think the means I'm using won't get those ends. It counts as rational. So that's perfectly consistent with thinking not all action is rational in some different sense, rationality. Now, remember I said that if we're acting, we're dissatisfied with existence and fairness. If everything were all right, then I wouldn't act. So we need one requirement for action is that we're dissatisfied with things. We have to think that we can do something to improve things. Now, Mises raises a very important point here is what is required for me to think that I can do something to improve things? Well, to do that, I have to be able to recognize causal relations. I need to know that doing certain things will bring about effect. If I didn't know that, I wouldn't ask. I mean, supposing, again, I want to give a lecture, so I know that opening my mouth and trying to produce certain sounds will have effect with saying something. If I didn't know that, I just thought, oh, I like this lecture. I had no idea how to talk or what I need to do to bring about speaking. I wouldn't be able to give a lecture. So causality is a fundamental category of action. If I didn't know that I could do certain things to get what I wanted, I wouldn't be able to act. I have to see in the world around me certain things will produce changes in other things in a regular way. And if I do certain things, it will have certain results. So causality is an extremely important category of action. We have Murphy's satisfied, and you also have to recognize causal relations. Now, one question, some of the people ask me, and I've been giving lectures at Mises University for over 25 years, so you hear all sorts of questions that people have about sex and knowledge. One question that I get quite a few times, usually somebody will ask nearly every year, is how do we know that other people act? Supposing I'm thinking about my own actions, I get all this and why act, if I'm dissatisfied or I have to understand causal relations in order to act. How do I know this applies to other people? How do I know, say, that you act because you're dissatisfied? Well, Mises has a very simple answer to this. He says, if we apply a category, it should be the category to other people, we'll find that they work, we'll find we're able to understand other people by using these categories. So, you see, Mises is not trying to solve the same kind of problem Descartes did. Remember, Descartes, in modern philosophy, said, I'm going to doubt everything I possibly can that could be doubted. Like, I could doubt that I'm looking at a computer screen now. Maybe it's just I'm just dreaming I'm looking at a computer screen. I could doubt that there are other people. One thing I couldn't doubt is that I'm thinking myself. So what Descartes was interested in doing was coming up with something that couldn't possibly be doubted. And then from there, he's going to try to prove the existence of the external world, the outside world, the existence of other minds. Mises isn't interested in that kind of philosophical problem at all. Mises takes for granted that there are other people and other people are acting, that you doubt this. You just apply the categories in which things that other people do act. But, so, he's not very important. Sometimes people think, because Mises is talking about a priori reasoning, which we'll be getting into next time. Some people think, well, Mises is some kind of Cartesian philosopher, just trying to think, how can we prove the existence of other minds from just impressively ourselves. That is not really doing that. Just assuming, of course, there are people, just like in the sciences, we physical sciences don't doubt there really is an external world. He's not doubting that either. I can hear what it means, anticipate from other minds. No, I mean, this was something Descartes raised, Mises pretty much dismissing that problem and trying to solve it. the reasons that why there wasn't a problem at that time. Okay, now, one thing, that was the last slide. One thing before I finish, I want to mention a point that came up. Those of you who took the quiz for my introductory lecture, right, as you'll see, I tried to make the quiz very easy. There were some people who missed a particular question. I thought, for sure, I didn't do a good job explaining them. When I said economics for me is a descriptive rather than normative science, what do we mean by distinction? Well, descriptive science is saying, kind of saying, the nature of the world, why things are a certain way. And normative science is what should things be like. For me, this takes economics to be a descriptive science, not a normative science, saying something. Here's how prices are determined, not saying prices ought to be determined this way. The right way to determine prices is objective. Then, so economics is descriptive rather than normative. Now, the point that I made got a few people confused, and I'm sorry about it. Mises does say we can kind of sneak a sense of odd statement into economics kind of by the back door. We can say, given that you have a certain goal or end, you can say what's the suitable means to achieve that. If you want, say we have unemployment in the economy, is a good way to solve that to increase government spending? Well, Mises would say, no, that isn't a good way to do that. When Mises says, this isn't a good means of achieving your goal, he's not making a normative statement. He's not saying it's wrong to achieve your goal there. He's just making a descriptive statement. You do that, you won't achieve your goal. So remember, when Mises economics is descriptive, not a normative. This, okay, so now at this point we're going to go to the question and answer period. So I need to, you can type either in the chat or in the Q&A. How do I set up the Q&A? Okay, somebody said they can hear me. Okay. Now here's one. Someone says, Andrew says, could you speak more about the idea of the ultimate given? Would the fact that human preference is a subjective example of it? What are some examples in ultimate science? Well, ultimate given, as an object, is something you can't go beyond. So that you can't analyze it further. So the fact that human preferences are subjective would be an example. Like if other scientists, well, supposing in physics, say, the existence of energy or certain subatomic particles possibly could be an ultimate given. It would be just something that couldn't be subjected to further analysis. If somebody said to a physicist, well, look, you know, you're talking about energy and how matter might have come into being from quantum fluctuations, whatever that means, but you don't explain the existence of quantum fluctuations, you would have to say, that's not something we can explain, at least right now. We're just starting with that. That's an ultimate gift. Okay. Thank you. Anybody else? That was a good question. I hope that isn't the ultimate given in the question.
I have a question.
Oh, yeah, here's one.
Okay, I was just wondering, sometimes I noticed in Jeffrey Herbener's lectures, he'll talk about the action axiom as something that cannot be refuted without demonstrating that what you're trying to refute. So, for example, you cannot deny the existence of action because in doing so you'd be acting, like denying would be acting. And so I wonder if that would be, Descartes says, I think, therefore I act. Would Herbener and Rothbard say, I refute, therefore I act?
That's a very interesting question. If I think Hans Hoffman used that sort of thing. Well, certainly, if someone has a thesis, there's no such thing as human action at all. So if he said that consciously, he was himself at the acting. So his saying that would show that his state was false. So it is similar to Descartes in that way. In case someone says that I'm not thinking, I doubt that I think, is that the doubting what itself in that process is doing. The one thing you do have to be very careful about, supposing someone just said human beings don't generally act, not action isn't a good category for explaining most human behavior, that wouldn't be refuted by this examiner. There's actually a parallel there where some people said if you deny the logical law of non-contradiction, law of non-contradiction says something can't be A and not A at the same time. Somebody says, well, I say law of non-contradiction is false, so then the person would say, well, aren't you then also saying law of non-contradiction is true because you said the law is false? So the contradiction, what you're saying, is true, so you're refuting yourself. Again, you have to be careful there because somebody could just say there is at least one true contradiction. So I could say that consistently with saying his statement is true in a non-contradictory way. That's pretty confusing, but I just thought I'd mention that. Okay, now do we have Neil says, did Bertrand Russell really receive a letter from Lady Plain Solomon was such a good idea, but she didn't know why more people that was a logician named Mrs. Ladd Brankley who wrote in Salton to view that only I exist. So she did actually write it. Mrs. Ladd Brankley wrote to Russell, so Russell said at any rate. Yeah, there are all sorts of good stories on Salton. I remember one Alvin Plantin years ago when he was at Wayne State University. He was supposed to be a professor in the medical school who was Salton. Some of the students were saying, well, we take very good care of this professor because when he goes, we all go.
Wasn't there a Muslim philosopher who said something funny about the law of non-contradiction? About they should be beaten?
Yes, I think it was something like if some assertion someone denies that he denies all non-contradiction, he should be beaten until he says there's some difference between being beaten and not being beaten. Yes, that's right. I think that's right. Stephen says, so for me, the idea that irrational action won't be an action with consciously result increasing the satisfaction. What needs to say there is whatever the person wants counts as satisfaction for him. So remember, this ontology, so that you couldn't constantly aim at increasing your satisfaction. But folks that thought, I'm a bad person, so I just like to punish myself a certain way, that would count as satisfaction for him. But you can't be, you can't come up, that means what you couldn't come up with an irrational action.
Because satisfaction is not the same thing as pleasure.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. It's just whatever you're aiming for now is satisfaction.
You could be a masochist.
Oh, yes. A lot of good masochists do that. Like masochists, like they people who take the course. What's that? I think that that is the conundrum. I'm trying to get my arms around. Well, you have to be careful if you try to hug it to run a conundrum. I'm hoping that for next week we should have the password for my new computer figured out, so we hope the sound will be much better. I hope it's all right this time. Oh, depends on whether it has sharp edges. Well, it wouldn't be a conundrum if the edges were so sharp. Now, Joe says that action can't be rash, but ends can be so constrained. Well, see, the thing here, you can certainly say, you could certainly have some view of what proper ends are for people. To possibly say, here's what a rational thing to aim at. But Mises doesn't go that way. He just says, you can't judge an ultimate end of someone irrationally rational. Just have to take that as a given. So you could say somebody has an irrational end if it's using that end just as a means of further end. But if there was no further goal, means to say no, the end isn't irrational, it's just there. We have to take that as a given. I don't know what he'd say about drink. I have to take a fall on that. Andrew says the behaviorist world is why we help. Well, I don't think it's as popular now as it was, say, 40, 50 years ago. You know, there are still, I think, some behaviors. Now, there was a famous review by Noam Chomsky of Skinner's book, B.F. Skinner, that is widely held to not solve behaviors. But I think there are still some behaviors left, but it's not too positive position. You know, I remember the joke I made. He told Hayek this one behavior, said the other, you're fine, how am I?
I always like the Sidney Morgan Besser quote when he said to B.F. Skinner, let me see if I can understand your thesis. We shouldn't anthropomorphize humans?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, Morgan Besser, they're all such a great Sidney Morgan Besser stories. I think he said, you know, Thomas Dawes just died a couple of weeks ago. He said to him, and he said, oh, I see. Your view is you have to be crazy to believe in mental illness. Oh, yes, I see Neil has the kind of more X-ray view there version of my joke. Yes, that's very good. I'm the only one you tell. Oh, good. Yes, I believe Skinner remained a behaviorist until his death, and probably after that as well. Dave said, I like Heber's article, Alain and Dave, did you read it? Did Heber achieve a craxological analysis? I'm not, which article was that?
It was a recent one.
I'm not familiar with it, but so I guess I can't answer the second part of it. So I'll have to have a look at that. Also, in fact, Mises would not accept the category irrational action. I mean, he wouldn't deny that in the way some people use the term irrational. There could be irrational action, but not in the sense he's introduced irrational. Where it just means that the attitude is selected certain means to achieve a purpose. So he wants it to work out, but there aren't irrational actions.
I noticed there's kind of a subtle difference between Rothbard and Mises on action, that Rothbard will often say that the action axiom is that action exists, but Mises never says action exists, and he doesn't say the word axiom either. It seems like he's deducing from concepts of action, where Mises is deducing from the concepts of action these categories of action, whereas Rothbard is deducing from the existence of action.
Yes, I think that's a very good point, that Mises is kind of more of a concept, so he's talking about what are the categories of human thought, and Rothbard is not. Rothbard is interested in more in necessary activities or things in the world. So Rothbard doesn't tend to think in terms of categories and all that. Is a different, it doesn't really have a that one I answered as ultimate given. Oh, now here's something. Idealist versus realism. Implicitly extent. Well, I don't think Mises would be an idealist in the sense of denying that the physical world exists or claiming that physical world consists of is ultimately the mental. Idealist can kind of sense that he thinks that we need certain categories to understand, in order to understand the world. And Rothbard tends to think those concepts are derived from the world abstract. Basically, it's different than where our concepts come from. Off topic, what task is the U.S. taking regarding the Constitution? Well, I think that's probably right, but you know, it's not really a topic I have any special expertise on. Maybe I don't have on this topic in top of my lecture, at least I can face it better on this topic than on yours. But I mean, I think you're right, hyperspatial is a possibility, but I don't think I could say anything especially useful about that. Let me see. Are we about out of time? Or is it more?
It's 7 o'clock our time.
Oh, okay, well, we'll hope to see you all next week, so thanks very much. Hope to see you again.
Yeah. And, yeah. let us know if the audio is okay, or and I'll review it too. And if it's just not okay, then we'll maybe do a local recording of it and make sure that we get the. But I did get emailed the password, so I'll now be able to set up David's brand new computer. So and it won't be in Starbucks. Okay. Thanks, everybody.